about 90% of those people were just idly wanting to know what Wall Street was doing, and very few of them wanted to actually deal with me in American and Canadian stocks. But the odd one or two did, and our business grew because we were an information provider on the floor of the exchange.
What did the other jobbers in your market feel about this?
Hated it. Tried to complain to the stock exchange. They said it was unfair that this crowd gathered. It was blocking the various walkways through the exchange, and it should be banned. But, you know, the stock exchange came along and frowned, and I said, well, you can't. This is information. You're going to ban it for. I mean, this is what the market's all about. I was a bit of a rebel in those days because this was not thought to be the done thing by the establishment. But I, you know, kept to it and forced my father, who was, by then he was probably the senior partner, actually. Major Love had died in the late 60s. I think my father took over as senior partner. There was this probably son whom he thought was probably a pain in the neck, but was, you know, had to admit was doing quite well. And so we better go along with these new modern ideas. So we were the first to do it, and that helped. But during the earlier part of the 70s, we certainly had established ourselves as the jobber in Americans, Canadians, from an information point of view, of disseminating that information. And then we moved towards going onto the new floor. But only before we did that, in 1972-73, I can't be too sure which year it was, the government extended exchange control to the old overseas sterling area countries. And to deal in other foreign securities at that time, prior to 1972-3, you had to go through this thing which was called the dollar premium. You had to buy your foreign currency to pay for transactions by literally going to a dealer in foreign exchange and paying a premium to pay to get that hold of that currency. The Bank of England monitored it all. There were other places where you could deal in the premium, but at the end of the day, all the records went back to the Bank of England. So they monitored the amount of demand for foreign currency, because, and this went right the way through to 1979. And according to the supply of demand for foreign currency, a premium developed on the quote for this currency, which was known as the dollar premium. And we used to make markets in this dollar premium thing, and we understood how to deal and convert the prices into sterling to make it simple for the brokers. And we would take on the responsibility on their behalf of working it back into dollars and putting all the records back to the Bank of England, because I felt that would attract them to deal with us rather than anybody else. The opposition caught up and did it as well.
This would all happen in the back office?
Yes, yeah. The actual deal in dollars we would do from the floor, but the brokers weren't necessarily aware of that, so it was somewhat irrelevant. Just to backtrack a little bit, I think it was 1965, the Labour government brought in a clause which said that on buying a foreign security, you pay this premium. On selling a foreign security, you surrender 25% of the premium to the government. So that if you bought a dollar, let's say an argument sent at 100% premium, it was effectively costing you, if it cost you a pound to buy a dollar, 100% premium, it was costing you £2 to buy a dollar. That was fine when you were buying it. And up to 1965, if you sold it and the premium remained unchanged, you would get your £2 back. But the government saw this as a source of revenue and a tax, so that if you did sell it and still got your 100% premium, instead of getting £2 back, you'd get £1.75. So 25p of each transaction went straight into the government. Now, directly this happened, I saw a further opportunity for us to actually handle those transactions, the surrender of 25% of the premium for the brokers. because it was going to be hugely confusing for them to A, to have a quote which was in sterling based on a dollar quote, which included whatever the ruling premium was, and that changed minute by minute according to supply and demand, to then turn around to be a seller, to sell at the ruling premium, to then have to do a transaction with a bank somewhere to surrender 25% of that value of the premium and tell the client what they'd done. So we very, after that budget, we as a firm, and John Purcell and myself thought this one through, that we would do that for the brokers. So if they dealt with us, we would give them the opportunity to handle that 25% surrender of the premium and give them, you know, sale proceeds, £2,000, give up 25% of the premium, £250. And we would book that out as a separate contract to them, and they had to do no more work at all. So that gave us a nice position in dollars and premium dollars, which we took a turn on, which was an additional turn to us making turns on securities. That helped enormously. Again, we got the reputation of being able to handle this. No other job was doing it at the time. They all followed suit in the end. But it helped us. And that went right the way through, this 25% give up, until I think that finished in the mid-70s. Something happened. The government said, all right, no more give up, but there was still the premium. But I can't be certain of that. So comes the early 70s, and we're still in the temporary exchange. We're standing back to back to a firm of jobbers that is specializing in South African securities called Lazarus Brothers. Nice firm, nice old boys, very few youngsters there. But George Lazarus, who was the senior partner, and his father before him, were the preeminent jobbers in South African gold shares in terms of experience and relationships, although Smith Brothers, who were involved in gold shares, were probably the better jobbers because they had a younger, more aggressive attitude to it, and this old boy was getting a little bit past it. Anyway, in 1972/3, when the government extended this 25% give up to the old sterling area securities, which brought in Australians, South Africans, this firm, Lazarus Brothers, hadn't got a clue. I mean, they just didn't know what to do. And they used to come round to us around the corner where we were standing and say, we've done a deal here. We've got to do a dollar surrender. We've got to put a premium into it. You know, can you show us how to do it? Of course, we showed them. You know, there was this tremendous spirit of cooperation, helping your competitors, etc. Anyway, we did so much business with them in stripping out their dollars and this premium, etc., that to cut a long story short, in the early part of 1973, I thought, why on earth don't we get together as two firms and merge the businesses? We don't deal in South Africans. You're not doing a lot, and I see potential, because we just 69, 70, we'd come off the gold standard. You know, where the gold was fixed, I think it was $32 or $38 an ounce, and was allowed to free itself, and was pretty quickly doubled into the 60s and 70s. And there was clearly more activity going to develop in gold and gold shares as a result. So I saw this as a window of opportunity. My fellow partners agreed, and as did the Lazarus partners, so we merged. In the early summer of 1973, and we changed the name of the firm to Stockton and Lazarus. And I became a senior partner in 1971. You know, my father thought probably it was easier to give in to me and those and my demands and excesses at that time, and so he decided to stand down as senior partner. And the other partners thought that they better let me continue to have my head, and I brought this fellow John Purcell and Tony Marshall into partnership with me at that time, and I took over as senior partner. The father stayed on for another few years, as did Pat Moore, the other partner. And so I was keen to expand it even further, and so when I saw this firm in 1973, I thought, we'll have a go at this, and we did merge. Changed the name of the firm to Stockton and Lazarus, and hit that just right, because 73-4, gold started moving up dramatically, and the Americans got involved, and they were buying gold coins and gold shares, and it was super. And we did very well during 74 and early 75. In 1975, I, or 74-5, I took over another firm called Bradford Brothers, which was a very small firm in the British industrial market. So for the first time, I branched out into British shares. And we were not part of the jobbing sort of fraternity that would at that time work towards agreeing fixed spreads, etc. And I wasn't going to have any of this, you know. I was going to go in there and compete with them. For the smaller business, I had no ambition to do the huge deals.
Was that what inspired you to take over Bradford? It was simply to widen the number of markets that you were dealing
in? We were then dealing in Americans, Canadians, South Africans, which were three very active markets still in the area. I had no ambition to go into Australians because settlement was so ghastly in the late 60s and early 70s, and I didn't think I could cope with that. So I pulled back from going into Australians. But I saw that there was an opportunity to expand into British stocks. By now, we were down to probably 20 or so jobbers only throughout the country. And I still had great faith in the jobbing system, and I thought it was going to go places. And I thought, well, let's have a go at the English market.
What was the attraction to Bradford?
Small firm, older senior partner, no youngsters in the firm. And if I hadn't taken them over, or somebody else taken them over, they'd have gone out altogether. And they had this pitch, especially in electricals and some of the store shares, where they had a following. They were good. So I thought this would be a nice little niche jobber to get into as a vehicle to expand into the equity market. You know, the big jobbers weren't too happy because I think they rather liked to have seen another jobber in that sector go altogether. I didn't find it too easy in the early days. I managed to attract a young trader from WED to join me, and I gave him that book, Mickey Gibbs. And he was very good, and he looked after that section. So I was building up my younger sort of lieutenants, if you like, and made them partners. To run these various pitches. Later that year, there was a big jobbing firm called Berger, and you may have interviewed one or two people from Berger.
That's coming up.
Right. The interviews are coming up.
Yes, can you picture?
Oh, great. Well, Berger had overtures to merge with Biscuit, Aykroyd, all sorts of jobbers, I think. Anyway, things weren't going quite as well as they thought. At the end of the day, Aykroyd decided they wanted to take the bulk of Berger, but they didn't want to take any of the foreign business. And Berger were good in mining finance, shares, some Rhodesians, and I negotiated with their partners at the time to take on what Aykroyd didn't want, really, but would have complemented the type of shares I was dealing in, because although I did South African gold shares, I didn't do what was called the mining financials, Consolidated Goldfield, Rio Tinto, those sort of stocks. And so I took them over. Now, one wasn't going to be successful all one's life, not make any mistakes. The mistake I made was buying their computer system. They had a very elaborate computer hardware, which was based in Throgmorton Street, opposite the exchange. I bought all that. I bought their computer operators and managers, and it was expensive. And I never got it working properly. It was the first sort of slip that I'd made. We were expanding well, we were making money in various areas, That was an unnecessary back office expense. I was on a bureau at the time, a computer bureau, and I thought it would be rather attractive. And I was advised by my financial partner that it would be quite a sensible thing to do. But it turned out to be poor advice. So comes the end of 1985. I finish up with having bought two firms in that sort of year.
75,
I beg your pardon, 1975. I bought two firms and expanded into other areas. We'd moved offices in 1974, so bigger suite of offices, you know, so the old expense side of it was going up.
How were you comparing at that stage with other firms in the stock exchange?
We were the sixth largest jobber. Mm. And, you know, there were the obvious six, you know, Wed, Aykroyd, Smith, Pynchon, Bisgood, and ourselves. And some other things were happening in 1975. Firstly, I was invited to stand for the council. The then chairman, George Loveday, was standing down, and we were going to have a chairman, Michael Marriott, with Williams de Bray. He was to be elected as chairman, and there was no doubt that he was going to be chairman. Michael had a very good understanding for the international market, and was one of the few people on the council that did understand the international market. It was dominated by domestic people, both jobbers and brokers. And I'd been frustrated over the years of 73, 4, and 5 over some of the rule changes that were going about, which was pushing the international market away from the jobbing system. And a particular rule in 1973, Rule 88B, I shall remember and probably have written on my grave, which allow, without any form of reference to the jobber, all brokers could do their business either directly in overseas markets or with the big houses like the Wood Gundys and the Merrill Lynches, etc., without any reference to the jobbers at all in that market. Whereas prior to that, they had to get a form signed, the white form as we used to call it, which if they could deal on better terms outside, the jobber had to sign the form and let it go outside, otherwise it wouldn't have been fair to the client. That was totally reasonable, and I didn't mind that at all. But they did away with the white form concept and just allowed the brokers to do all their foreign business away from the jobbing system, which totally negated the concept of single capacity on the basis the jobber would stand there and make prices, providing the brokers brought their business to the broker and vice versa. The broker wouldn't take principal positions. So that all went in 1973 with this wretched rule change called Rule 88B. So I had mounted some sort of campaign to try to ease the effect that would have, not with a great deal of success. And I'd started going up in front of committees and moaning and groaning and trying to say, well, you're ruining the system for the international community, etc., and had the support of the fellow jobbers in the international community for taking this somewhat high moral stance. And Michael Marriott, I think, became aware of that in 1975, and particularly asked me to stand for the council and that I would get the support of the council members and there would be an international voice. I needed this like a hole in the head because I was really hands-on senior partner, not only running a book, but trying to control the expansion of the firm, and it was going well. But very difficult to turn down such an approach from the new chairman, and on the basis that if I could influence rule changes which would be more appropriate for the international community, then my firm would benefit, other firms would benefit, and it would be good for the stock exchange because we were losing the international business. So I stood for the council, and I got on, as there was little doubt that I would, because I had the support of other people. And I became a regulator. I became involved in committees, etc., and I loved it. I mean, the cut and thrust of the committee debates and looking at the various things in rule changes for the exchange, and the ability that I had as being a hands-on day-to-day practitioner, I found fascinating and did find I could influence the thinking of the various committees. I mean, within a year, I was deputy chairman of the then Markets Committee under Anthony Steele, who sadly died some years later. The worst thing, from my point of view, was, and it was even more so for the Marriott family, Michael Marriott died in the December, I think it was, of that year of 75. And I think we lost, as an exchange, what would have been a great chairman who had very broad idea of where the exchange should be going in an international way, in a global way. And Nicholas Goodison was appointed in 1976. And Nicholas was fine. I mean, he had a wonderful brain, and I think Nicholas was a good chairman. But he didn't have that international flavor that Michael had had. And after sort of 6 months of moving towards internationalizing the exchange, we went right back to square one under Nicholas's chairmanship. And the old guard got back into control, and we did nothing to improve the international approach.
What had you been working towards during the previous 6 months? You said you'd been.
We were working towards something which was known as the Marriott proposal, which would be to allow jobbers and brokers to both open up offices abroad and be members of the various exchanges, but more particularly to allow the jobbing firms to deal freely with members of overseas exchanges, so that you get this would balance it. The brokers could be dealing overseas from the rule change earlier, and the jobbers would have this freedom to do so as well. And we would attract that business more back to the stock exchange, because the jobbers would be the funnel for bringing it back in, if you like, the conduit, because they'd have more access to our international business, which I thought was a very good proposal.
What service did you feel the jobbers could provide to the broker on the floor of the house that he wouldn't necessarily get by going to a firm like Merrill Lynch?
No better a service, but as good a service. Because the Merrill Lynches and the Wood Gundys, very fine firms, not members of the exchanges, therefore didn't have the same ability to deal during account periods, free of commissions and all that sort of thing. So the broker coming to the jobber was dealing and just simply dealing net. He was having to pay a commission to deal with the outside houses. So there could have been a price advantage. But in fairness, we couldn't say that we could give any better a service, but certainly as good as and part of the membership of the exchange, which in those days was still very much single capacity, and it was all done on unlimited liability. I mean, there's no sort of limited liability companies in the exchange. So we could have retained the system at no disadvantage to either the international investor or the broker that had international ambitions.
What was the attraction to the brokers then to go to the outside houses? They feel they could get a closer price.
Reciprocity. The outside brokers would attract them to give them their business in foreign shares on the return for giving them English orders. And I mean, it was a very compelling, a very tempting thing to do. If you wanted to go and buy, you know, a few thousand shares of IBM, give that to Merrill Lynch or Wood Gundy if it was a Canadian share, or more particularly, you would virtually get back in commission, dollar for dollar, an order to buy some ICI or BP.
So there was nothing per se in the actual stock exchange mechanism that was causing the brokers to go to the outside houses rather than you as the jobbers?
No. Reciprocity and, well, I suppose, to be fair, research. The big American and Canadian houses in their respective companies, their national membership, did have better research. But not something that the jobbers couldn't have access to. I mean, I had access to all the research in America, and if that somebody particularly wanted to research on a company, I'd have got it for them with no charge. So, but it was an angle which they did feel was more natural, that if you wanted research on an American share, you'd get a Merrill Lynch. If it was Canadian share, you'd get a Wood Gundy. You don't want to go to Stockton Lazarus as a jobber on the floor of the stock exchange. What on earth do they know about American and Canadian shares?
What proportion of the business did you feel was being now done outside of the house in the markets in which you were dealing?
What was 80-90%. I mean, it had virtually all gone from the really good investment business. The sort of business we were doing was the speculative account type dealing in some of these oil and Canadian shares. These North Sea oil shares and these Irish Canadian shares, which were far more English in makeup, really, than they were Canadian or American. And we had a handle on everything that was going on there. And we made very keen close prices. So we attracted the business there by the keenness of our price and size. But we couldn't do that in IBM.
So what were the consequences for the firm itself? Were you suddenly, was turnover suddenly drying up? Were you simply doing less business?
No, it wasn't drying up. Not that we were doing very much less, but it was would have been very difficult to expand. I mean, we went into it in the knowledge that we were going to be a very poor secondary market to the major domestic markets in America and Canada, and we had a total realization of that situation. But we did feel that if we were efficient, we would be able to attract business from the brokers under single capacity because there was an obligation to come and deal with us. But we had to be efficient in price formation and dealing and expenses, et cetera, dealing, which we felt we could offer. But when the rules changed and there was no compunction to come and even ask us a price, you know, we weren't going to expand in any meaningful way into those markets. The small regional stockbrokers whom we developed a very good rapport with from 1973 when we had the Federal Exchange approach, they were very loyal to the jobbing system. So we got a lot of business from the country brokers. And the small London-based brokers, because they didn't have the wherewithal to contact the big Merrill Lynches of this world. And they certainly didn't want to get involved in all the expenses of communicating with a firm directly in America or Canada or anywhere else in the world, come to that. So we attracted their business, and I think we provided a very easy and good alternative to the domestic markets. But if you're in a business and you want to expand and all the time, you've got to be able to see an opportunity out there. If it's blocked to you by some regulation, then it makes it tough. And so during 1975, because the rules did permit a jobber to, for the first time, and this was a rule change, at the same time in 1973, that changed with this Rule 88B, it did permit any member of the exchange, jobbers and brokers, to open up overseas offices. Mm-hmm. So I thought that if I wasn't going to beat them here on their home ground, that I would actually open up an office in New York. So having dealt with my friendly correspondent, Colonel Aaron Kaufman, we decided to buy control of that firm and become members through them of the New York Stock Exchange. So at least we'd be able to say to our brokers in London, well, why are you going to New York? I mean, you're doing the equivalent in London with a New York member firm. So it did help.
And in effect, your New York office was serving the same function previously filled by your correspondent.
Yes, I mean, it was just ownership which changed. But it did give us the ability, from a marketing point of view, in London, to be able to say it's not just a joint account. This is a sister company. We didn't change the name because it wouldn't have been right to do so from the New York point of view. So we were expanding into that, and that was good. It probably was not an ideal time to do it because in America in 1975, May Day, negotiated commissions, etc. It was getting tough for the small American brokers to survive, let alone us going over there. So Fortunately, we developed that firm as a trading firm. We did think at one stage it might be useful to actually become a specialist on the New York floor and link up in that way, but we toyed with the idea of doing that, but we never quite went down that route. So as a trading firm, Kerndler and Kaufman didn't suffer too much out of negotiated commissions, and it was a very good vehicle for undoing our book and creating positions that we wanted to do to undo in London. So that was quite an active year for me, 75. We took over these two firms, opened up in New York. I went on the council, and you know, there was quite a lot of business around anyway. In 1976, the early part of 76, the gold share market went into a nosedive. Everything turned around, and there was very little activity going on in gold shares. The economy here, if you recall, was pretty tricky during 75, 76. It wasn't easy for anybody to survive. And the stock exchange had been referred to the Office of Fair Trading, Restrictive Practices Court, that was it. Which I don't think any of us realized in 1976 how important